This episode contains the topics of child abduction, child abuse, mutilation, and sexual sadism. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to Momicide Podcast. I'm Amanda, and Kristen is not here at this very moment because our recording software decided to ever so kindly delete the first 5 minutes of the episode after I had finished editing it. So you got me for the first few minutes, and I'm going to retell the beginning of the story that Kristen had previously told. It'll be a lot less engaging because I'm not going to converse with myself, but I essentially just have to do the intro and introduce the beginning of the story. Today, Kristen will be telling us the story of the Baraboo Bonebreaker. In the summer of 1995, a 13-year-old boy would throw himself down a flight of stairs in order to call for help. He had been held captive for almost 2 days, being tortured in the worst imaginable way. His abductor was a sexual sadist who had a fascination with the sound of breaking bones. The boy had suffered multiple leg fractures and was on death's door by the time the police found him. He was the lucky one. The abductor had done the same to another teenage boy a year prior, with this boy's body being found badly decomposed in a nearby river. The person responsible for this was the neighborhood bully, a 17-year-old sociopath named Joseph Clark. This is the case of the Baraboo Bonebreaker. This story takes place in Baraboo, Wisconsin. Baraboo has a population of approximately 12,000 and is located 50 miles north of the state capital of Madison, Wisconsin. Baraboo is a beautiful and picturesque city, nestled among rolling hills and valleys. It's most famous for its circus heritage, and for being the home of the Ringling Brothers, who founded America's most infamous traveling circus in 1884. In mid-July 1995, 13-year-old Thaddeus Phillips had just moved to Sauk County, Baraboo with his parents, Connie and Donald, and his three siblings. They settled into their new home at East 13608A County Trunk Highway U, which was located on a beautiful country backroad. It was at this point that Kristen did show me a picture of Thad. If you're new here, we post all of the pictures that we discuss in the episode on our Instagram so that you can refer to the picture either during or after you listen. 2 weeks after adjusting to his new beginning, Thad's young life would change forever. On the evening of July 29th, 1995, Thad fell asleep on the couch in his living room while watching a movie with his younger sister. At some point during the night, Thad feels himself being picked up and carried to his bed, which was a common thing his father would do if he fell asleep on the couch. Except this night, he was not being carried to his room. Before Thad could realize what was going on, he felt the cool evening air hit his face and realized that he was being carried outside. At this point, he knows that this is not his father, but he doesn't know who it is. It's dark outside. Thad is groggy and tired and very confused. The person carrying him eventually drops him down on the ground and asks him to follow him down the road, saying he's having car troubles. Thad was weary but agreed. He said he thought that maybe this was one of his father's buddies that needed help with something. Thad follows the man to a dark, dilapidated home just down the road from his own home, and the man invites Thad inside. Once the pair entered the home, Thad finally caught a glimpse of his abductor, who was not a man at all but a teenage boy who looked to be just a few years older than him. The boy introduced himself as Joe Clark and told Thad he was 17 years old and was having some friends over for a party that night, and told Thad he should stay and hang out. Joe even went as far as to list off a few people who were coming to this so-called party, and Thad actually knew a few of them. At this point, Kristen showed me a picture of Joe, one of him in street clothes and then another of him in his jumpsuit. So at this point, he assumed that maybe Joe was actually a friend of his older brother. And being a naive and trusting 13-year-old, this also put him at ease. Joe asks Thad if he likes model cars and baseball and leads him to the upstairs bedroom while the pair waited for the friends to arrive. As Thad was making his way through the house, he was alarmed by the awful living conditions. The place looked like it had been ransacked. There were dirty clothes strewn everywhere, rotten food and dirty dishes covering every surface, and empty beer bottles all over the floor. Up in the bedroom, Joe started showing off his collection of model cars, and the two started talking about sports. It was at this point that Kristen showed me some pictures and videos inside the home, and it essentially looks like something from an episode of Hoarders. There is garbage and clothes and beer bottles all over the house. There was also a video of a closet that was just piled with garbage. And now Kristen will take it away, and we will be back to our regularly scheduled programming, or our regularly recorded episode. Apologies if the first 5 minutes were boring with only one host, but I hope you enjoy the rest of the episode.
So at this point, a lot of people are probably thinking, like, why are you just going along with all of this? He literally abducted you off your living room couch in the middle of the night and, like, is now, you know, bringing you into this weird, crazy, like, abandoned looking home, and you're just gonna sit there and, like, shoot the shit. And Thad himself doesn't really fully comprehend why or how he really agreed to this. He just was kind of, you know, suddenly woken up from a deep sleep. He's in a brand new neighborhood. He doesn't really know anybody. And I think it does really come down to him being 13 years old. And like, I'm just trying to put myself in his mind frame and just kind of not really fully comprehending like the dangers of the world and just thinking that, you know, everybody has good intentions. Like, I don't know. But.
And some people are dangerously polite. And he definitely was confused if he had just woken up. And then he might have thought to himself, this guy is being so nice and welcoming. I don't see any red flags from him yet, so I'm just going to be polite.
Right.
But yeah, that is terrifying.
Thad speaks on why he agreed to it during an interview for a documentary and says, quote, "I don't know how to explain that. I can't explain that. I don't know what I was thinking. I don't know why. I was looking around and he was being the nicest guy in the world. Talking about model cars and baseball cards and football cards, and that's what I was into at the time. We were sitting on his bed and he was sitting next to me. All of a sudden he stood up," unquote. Out of nowhere, Joe's mood changed and Thad saw a flash of evil in his eyes. He stood up and shoved Thad down onto the bed as hard as he could. Thad was less than 5 feet tall and maybe 100 pounds, and Joe, who was almost a foot taller and 80 pounds heavier than he was, could very easily overpower Thad. Nonetheless, Thad began fighting back with all of his might, and it was at this moment that he knew he was in immediate danger and he needed to get the hell out of that house. Joe was able to sit on top of Thad's legs, and with a firm grip on Thad's foot, he twisted it as hard as he possibly could until he felt the bone snap. Thad's right ankle was broken. Shock immediately rushed over his body. Joe quickly stood up, backed away, and momentarily put his hands up to his face as if he was shocked by what he had just done. He started closing his eyes and mumbling to himself, and during this split-second moment, Thad tried to make a run for it. Thad later explained this, saying, quote, "He kind of looked away, and as soon as he looked away, I got up and ran as fast as I could down the stairs. You can't run very fast with a broken ankle. But I got down the stairs and through his living room and into the kitchen before he finally caught up to me. He put me in a hold and dragged me back into his living room," unquote. During this moment, Thad had so much adrenaline running through his body that he said he didn't feel any pain from the broken ankle, but he does recall the feeling of running on it, saying he could feel the broken bone slipping past his foot bone as he ran, and he said it was one of the strangest feelings ever.
What the hell?
So, I don't know if you've ever had a broken bone before.
I haven't.
I haven't either. So, I feel like people who have broken bones before, this episode is going to be very hard to listen to because you would kind of like have an idea of how that would feel. It's hard enough for me to even, you know,
imagine.
Yeah. So Joe immediately punished Thad for trying to escape. He was once again able to push him down and overpower him. He grabbed Thad's right leg yet again, and this time he pushed it up past Thad's head as far as he could, putting all of his body weight on it until he felt Thad's femur snap. Thad remembers hearing an audible popping noise as this happened, and it sent him immediately reeling in pain, which caused him to pass out.
His femur.
Your femur, which is your thigh bone, which is the longest and strongest, thickest bone in your body.
And you also have a main artery.
Right.
That runs there, and you can die. It is a very large main blood vessel that brings blood to your entire lower half.
Right.
It's very serious.
Right. Yeah, I'm wondering if the bone breaking would have any effect on that artery at all. I'm sure it, you know, has a high potential, but, like, even the fact that he was able to break his femur in the first place is, like, wild to me.
He just snapped it.
Yeah. So I looked up how many pounds of pressure this would take, and it said that it would take an average of 1,700 to 2,500 pounds of force to break an adult femur, and apparently younger individuals have more resilient bones compared to adults due to their ongoing growth and development. I can't even picture what that looks like 2,500 pounds of force. I don't know how this kid was able to do this just by leaning on it. I don't think he was just leaning on it. Like, obviously, he was being incredibly violent, but
he must have had some sort of momentum going to create that force.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he did. So Thad didn't know how long he had passed out for, but when he came to, Joe was sitting on the couch next to him, acting happy and like the nicest guy in the world again. Thad told Joe that he wanted to go home, which Joe told him that wasn't going to happen. Thad asked him, "Why are you doing this to me?" And Joe started explaining how he was always fascinated with the sound of bones as they were breaking. Thad asked him why doesn't he just do it on himself, and Joe said that he's tried before, but he just couldn't get the angles right. Like, what the fuck? He then threw Thad on the couch and told him to get some sleep while he made himself comfortable on the other couch and immediately dozed off. Thad obviously couldn't sleep, nor did he want to. Instead, he utilized this time by trying to look around for something he could defend himself with. He tried to slide off the couch, and this is when the pain really kicked in and sent his body into tremors. Paralyzed by pain and fear, Thad just laid there on the floor, wide awake all night, praying that his father or someone would come to rescue him. This is so sad, and also, pain sending your body into tremors is a real thing. I experienced this after my second labor, with, like, the contractions that happen after you have a baby.
Yeah.
They were almost worse than the first, like, actual labor contractions, and I was, like, shaking. I didn't know, like, how to stop it, so.
To be in pain like that and scared for your life and unable, frozen and unable to do anything about it.
Right.
At 13.
Yeah.
That is horrific.
And, like, him just wanting his dad to, like, come and, you know, find him is just heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Back at Thad's house, his mother, Connie, had already woken up around 4 a.m. to go check if Thad had made it to bed that night. To Connie's surprise, Thad's younger sister was still asleep on the couch, but Thad was gone. She said he never would have left his sister alone on the couch like that. She woke up her husband, Donald, and the two searched every room of the house for Thad, but he was nowhere to be found. Strangely enough, the light in the kitchen was left on and the front door of the house had been left open, but Thad's shoes were still in the house where he normally kept them. So it's like, obviously, if he left the house, he would have put his shoes on. He's not going to leave barefoot in the middle of the night. So this was very bizarre to them. The following morning, there was a small part of Thad that thought maybe Joe would let him go. He asked him if he could call his parents, and surprisingly, Joe agreed. He passed him an old phone, and Thad frantically started dialing his parents' phone number when Joe started to cackle. He had just cut the phone cord and took great pleasure in watching the fear and disappointment wash over Thad's face. They spent the next 2 hours talking and watching TV together in the living room, and Thad was trying his best to be Joe's friend in hopes to ward off another attack. This only worked for a while, however, because at some point, Joe switched his attention back onto Thad with the same evil, unprovoked look of rage in his eyes. He picked up Thad and drug him back upstairs, where he repeated the same torture he inflicted the day before, except this time with the opposite leg. Joe grabbed a dirty sock and shoved it in Thad's mouth to try to muffle the screams as Thad was trying to fight back. Joe grabbed a hold of Thad's left ankle and twisted it until the bone popped. Thad says, quote, "I punched him in the back, and he turned around and put a pillow over my face and told me that if I didn't stop fighting, he was going to break my neck or my back. So I was trying to slow it down. Everything was just happening so fast, and I didn't want a broken back or broken neck, so I basically just did what he wanted me to do. I just wanted to get out of that house and back to mine," unquote. And, like, he really believed that he was capable of breaking his back or neck because he's already broken 3 of his bones now.
And he broke his femur.
Yeah. So
if you can break that, you can snap a neck.
Yeah.
So that is so scary.
He's thinking, like, I don't want to be paralyzed, so I'm just going to lay here and let this guy do whatever. At this point, it had been about 18 hours that Thad had been trapped in that house, and he has 2 broken ankles and a broken femur. Back at home, Thad's parents, Donald and Connie, had been frantically searching everywhere for him all day. So, remember, they had just moved into town 2 weeks prior, and they didn't really know the best places in town to look for their son. But regardless, they did try to search the entire town and surrounding areas, including the community fair and local rivers. But they weren't able to find him. After searching for Thad all day, his parents phoned the county police to file a missing persons report. Because there was no evidence found in the Phillips home, there wasn't much the police could do at the time, but they told the parents to stay close to the phone in case the police came across anything. Connie, Thad's mother, would speak on this and say, quote, "I was looking out the window. I was just waiting for the phone to ring. I just couldn't believe what was going on. I didn't know what to think. I just wanted to hear from him. It was hell," unquote. Cannot imagine.
Oh, no, I can't. I can't even bring my mind to that.
I'd be fucking
place.
Beside myself.
Yeah.
During their search, Thad's parents made one crucial mistake. They never thought to go knocking on the doors of nearby neighbors. Thad was locked in a home being mercilessly tortured just less than 0.5 mile down the road on the same street that they lived on. So Thad lived at 13608 County Road U, and Joe lived on the corner of 13807 County Road U and Hine Road. The distance between the houses is less than 0.5 mile, or about 3/4 of a kilometer. And to put it in perspective, that's a 56-second drive down the road if you're going the average speed limit. So I feel like to come to find out that your child is literally that close to you and you have no idea where he is for that long would just be torturous.
Absolutely.
And I'll show you a picture of the map so you can see the 2 houses and how close they are.
So did he carry him through the woods?
There's a street that goes.
Okay.
You can kind of see it there.
Okay, and it could just go straight to that. Oh.
This is just a distance
right. Kind
of marker. But yeah, the street does go kind of straight there. I don't think he carried him the whole way. He like dropped him on the ground at one point and like made him walk. But yeah, it really was not very far at all. And why the parents didn't go knocking on the doors of the neighbors, like, I don't really know. This is a very rural area. There's really not many houses, and there's like quite a distance in between houses. So I just feel like they never really thought that that was a possibility.
Right.
While his parents were sick with worry about where their son was, 13-year-old Thad was doing anything he could to spare himself another minute from the torture. Joe was like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. One moment he'd be acting friendly and acting like the, quote, nicest guy ever, as Thad would say. And the next moment, he'd be out of his mind with rage. But as much as Joe enjoyed breaking bones, he would tell Thad that what he liked even better was trying to fix them and put them back together. Joe had a dresser drawer filled to the brim with hundreds of pairs of brand new, pristine condition men's white socks. He took the socks and would pull them up onto Thad's legs in multiple layers as if to create a makeshift cast. Joe took great care in how he placed the socks on Thad's legs, making sure every thread and seam was perfectly lined up and marveling in the entire process of this, as if it was an exciting part of his sick ritual. He would also take ACE bandages and wrap those around Thad's legs as compression wraps. This is when Joe stood above Thad and started to masturbate. Like, you sick fucking freak.
I knew it was coming because of the mention at the beginning, but I was just hoping it wasn't ever coming.
Yeah. And as if it couldn't get any worse, Joe had stolen a pair of old leg braces from the hospital and would put them on Thad and then force him to get up and walk around the house on his broken legs. While he had the leg braces on Thad, he kicked him down the flight of stairs as he stood at the top. Thad would explain this and say, quote, "He wrapped those elastic bandages around me and he had these leg braces from the hospital or something, I don't know. He was putting those on me, and he had socks, and he put layers and layers of socks on my feet. They had to be just perfect, every single sock, unquote. After Joe would play doctor, he'd go right back to undoing everything and torturing Thad some more. Those are the leg braces. And by the way, if you're a new listener of ours, follow us on Instagram because we post all of these pictures that we're mentioning in the episode so that you can see them.
So he tortures him, breaks his bones, pretends to fix him, undoes it, and tortures him some more.
Mm-hmm. While he's pleasuring himself. Yeah.
I don't have anything to say.
So criminal psychologist Dr. John Mayer speaks on Joe's twisted obsessions and says, quote, "There was some childlike fascination with fixing him and making him right so that he could go on to torture him even more. He had that, forgive the term, captive audience for as long as he wanted. The fun was in making him dysfunctional again," unquote. Joe would not only break Thad's ankles, but he'd go back to them after they'd been fractured and would continue twisting and twisting them some more. Thad said he was twisting his ankles so hard that his skin looked like a twisted up rubber band. Dr. John Mayer says, quote, "There's this incredible feeling of having a living human being captive. You can hurt them and manipulate them so much, and that's what he was fascinated with," unquote. And with these types of people, they're not thinking of them as humans. They're literally thinking of them as objects and like marveling in the fact that like, oh my God, like I have this human captive and like it's mine, and what am I gonna do to like torture this thing? Like it's fucked.
It's just a vessel to carry out his sick, twisted thoughts.
Yeah. The repeated torture and mending sessions would go on all day. Joe told him that he would be leaving for the evening, so he put Thad in his bedroom before leaving and told him to not even think of trying to escape. Before leaving, Thad could hear Joe downstairs talking to someone, but couldn't hear anyone talking back. He was having a one-way conversation, and Thad came to the realization that there must have been another working phone in the house. He waited for Joe to leave and knew he had to find a way to make it to this phone so he could call for help. Once he heard the car pull out of the driveway, Thad slid his body off the bed and dragged himself to the bedroom door. He managed to reach his arm up to the door handle and jiggle it open. From there, he dragged himself down the hallway and to the top of the staircase. He knew he had to get down those stairs, so he tried sliding his broken legs down first, but the pain was too intense. Instead, he had to throw himself down the staircase head first. Thad passed out from the pain. Thad explained what happened next by saying, quote, "I threw myself down the stairs and dragged myself into the living room, but I kept passing in and out. And I don't know how many hours it took. But then he came back home with his girlfriend. And I'm thinking, be smart, don't make him mad. So I'm going in there and I'm rustling around and I'm being quiet as hell. I almost got to the kitchen doorway, right before it. And I can hear them. They're in there talking and kissing and stuff, and I hear her leave," unquote. Thad said he wanted to scream out for help, but he didn't know if the girlfriend would help Joe in the torturing. He continues by saying, quote, "He comes walking into the living room and his eyes just bulge out of his head to see me down there like that," unquote. Joe drugged Thad back upstairs and told him that what he'd experienced so far was only a warm-up and soon enough he'd have to pay for trying to escape. Thad ended up passing out from physical exhaustion, and when he woke up the next morning, the torture continued full force. Thad describes how Joe, quote, "busted up his legs some more." From the opposite end of the bedroom, he would get a running start as he jumped up in the air and came down onto Thad with his knees. He would do this over and over again, bearing down with all of his body weight as he slammed down as hard as he could onto Thad's swollen and broken legs. Eventually, one of the blows broke Thad's left kneecap, sending his kneecap completely backwards onto the other side of his leg. He was also jumping up and down on his ribcage.
How does a person survive this?
Don't know.
I can't believe that he was able to not only survive this, but then to recount it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Just doesn't seem real to me, and it makes me queasy.
Yep, I know. It's actually insane. Thad describes this night and says, quote, "Right before he left Sunday night was the worst. That's when he did the most damage, I think. He was actually grunting when he'd do it. That was the most painful day," unquote. He went on to say, quote, By the time he was done jumping on my knees with his knees, my left knee was backwards, totally. My kneecap was on the other side of my leg, and both of my feet were completely sideways, unquote. Criminal psychologist John Mayer speaks on this and says, quote, "A perpetrator like Joe has no sense of the pain that he is inflicting. They have no capacity for empathy. They could do the most devastating thing to you and smile and walk away, then go to the ice cream shop and have a big ice cream sundae," unquote. At one point, Thad asked Joe if he had done this to anybody else, to which Joe responded that he had, and he named two boys. He asked Thad if he knew a boy named Chris Steiner, to which Thad responded that he thought the name sounded familiar. Thad said, quote, "He was just evil. I could tell in his facial expression and in his eyes, here he comes again," unquote. Thad started pleading with Joe to let him go, and Joe would say things like, "I can't do that now, it's too late." And Thad said that he'd make up a story and say that he just tripped over a table or something. Joe said that nobody would ever believe that. Thad kept trying to talk to him in an attempt to distract him long enough to ward off the next blow. He knew that Joe would be going out with his girlfriend again, and during his violent outburst, Thad would tell Joe that he heard someone coming. Scared that his girlfriend would arrive and find him with a teenage boy captive, Joe would rush over to the window to see if anyone was coming. When he realized no one was there, the beatings would continue. Thad would tell Joe multiple times that he heard someone coming again, in an attempt to spare himself even a 10-second break in between beatings. Thad later spoke on this and said, quote, "Before he left that night, he made sure he busted me up pretty good so that I wouldn't try to leave again. I thought, if I can't get out of here yet, I was going to die. But I knew that wasn't going to happen. I was going to get out of there," unquote. This entire time, Thad said that he didn't ever cry in front of Joe and he didn't let him know how scared he was. Finally, the girlfriend did arrive, and Joe locked Thad inside the bedroom closet this time. The closet was piled high with old junk and dirty clothes. There was hardly any room for Thad to move around in there, and the heat was absolutely suffocating. He was also severely dehydrated at this point. So that's the closet that you saw in the video.
Right.
That's where he was locked. Due to the repeated blows to Thad's legs and multiple broken bones, internal bleeding had started to build up in his legs. Thad didn't realize that this was happening, and it can become fatal if left unattended. So, as you were saying, with the artery there.
Right.
Which I had no idea, but it completely makes sense.
Yep.
The pain in his legs was excruciating and almost unbearable. That particular day was his brother's birthday, and he said he really wanted to be with his family. He said that was the only thing that kept him going. Thad started feeling around inside the dark closet for something to break the door with. He finds a metal thermos and starts using it to hit the door, but it wasn't heavy enough. He kept searching for something bigger. He said, quote, "I wanted to get out of that closet and back downstairs to that phone. I started looking around and digging through stuff, and I ended up finding an old wooden electric guitar," unquote. He used the guitar to smash a hole through the closet door and was successful. He knew that he had to seize the opportunity to make a run for it and didn't have any time to waste. Just like the day before, Thad drug himself out of the room and down the hall towards the staircase. He once again threw himself down headfirst. The pain he was experiencing at this point was so unbearable that he was passing out momentarily every few feet that he moved. Thad finally made it into the kitchen and saw the phone hanging up on the wall. So this was in the 90s, and this was one of those old, like, coiled phone cord, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like hang up on the wall with a long coiled cord.
Mm-hmm. Was it one of those that you had to take the number and, or was it, wasn't that?
No, it was one you like pulled it off the base and just like dialed the numbers.
Right.
Or the numbers were like on the base.
Yes.
It wasn't like super old school, but yeah, it was not a cordless
People
phone.
Don't own home phones anymore, so
right.
Yeah, pretty old school.
Yeah, it's an antique.
Yeah.
Thad was able to reach his arm up high enough to grab a hold of the cord and wiggle the phone down. And some of these phones, like I said, the buttons can either be on the base that's attached to the wall,
right,
or they can be on the actual like receiver handset. And lucky for Thad, the buttons were on the receiver.
Oh, goodness.
And he was able to dial 911. Thad had no idea where he was, but he did his best to try to explain who his abductor was and the host that he thought he had been taken to. Police knew right away where he was because they had dealt with Joe before. You can hear police corresponding with the 911 dispatcher and also dispatch talking to Thad when the police actually arrive. During the 911 call, Thad was so calm and collected that the officers were worried that this was a prank call. Nonetheless, they arrived to the host 30 minutes after the call was placed. As they approached the host, the police said that they felt a sense of evil. So this isn't the actual 911 call. This is the dispatcher speaking with the police, but you can kind of hear them talking back and forth.
Okay.
And then you can hear the dispatcher talking to Thad as the police arrive, and then you can kind of hear what's happening after.
Let's get a call. Yes. And he's kidnapped. He's in a house on Highway U. Both his legs are broken and his ankle. Yeah, better not be a joke. I'm sorry I got that here. He says, no, he's just getting me out of here as soon as you can.
Okay, the officers are there. Hold on. Stay on with me, though, okay?
Mm-hmm. Police! Dad?
Right here.
Wait, anybody else here with you?
Nope, just me.
Sorry.
I can't believe how young he sounds in that clip.
I know.
Like, you can tell that he's a kid.
Yeah. Yeah, and the police must have, when they found him, they must have tried to, like, lift him up or something, and you can kind of hear at the end there that he's, like, wailing in pain.
Right.
I can't even imagine what was going through these police officers' minds as they walked in on this, but, like, absolutely horrifying. When they walked in, what they saw was horrific. Thad was laying on the kitchen floor. His left knee was totally backwards, and both of his feet were sideways. His ankles were swelled to the size of softballs, and his thighs were swelled to the size of basketballs. He also had two black eyes, and his body was covered in bite marks and large purple and yellow bruises. Thad's body could only be described as comparable to what you would see in a horrible car accident. So here's a few pictures of the injuries. You're not really kind of able to tell. Like, I feel like these pictures don't fully do it justice, right, but kind of gives you an idea.
His leg is just completely twisted.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell it's just so swollen.
Yeah. And you can kind of tell with, like, the way his feet are kind of, like, just laying out to the sides that there's no, like, ankle support there.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so, like, it just makes my stomach turn. Constable Thomas Pollard would speak on this, saying, quote, "His legs were so bruised, almost to the point of being black. I've never seen a young man with so much grit. It was almost like not believing what you were seeing, because I expected him to be screaming in pain, and he was just as stoic as anybody I'd ever seen," unquote. Another responding officer, John Hansen, said, quote, "I can't believe somebody was kept in that closet. I can't believe he busted out of there. I can't believe he was still alive," unquote. While in the ambulance, the paramedics informed Thad that he would have died within 2 hours due to the internal bleeding in his legs. After suffering 43 hours of torture, Thad was finally reunited with his family at the hospital. Once his parents realized that their son was just down the road the entire time, they were overcome with guilt for not knocking on the doors of their neighbors. Doctors had to rush to save Thad's legs. There was a high probability that they'd need to be amputated. He would have to undergo multiple surgeries for the doctors to put his legs and hips back together with rods and pins. Later that night, on the evening of July 31st, 1995, police were staking out Joe's house in undercover vehicles and waiting for him to return, which eventually he did, and he was placed in handcuffs and arrested. Joe immediately goes on the defense, saying he didn't do anything wrong and that he only brought Thad over so that they could hang out. Like, yeah, okay. Soon after Thad was able to calm down and come to the realization that he was finally safe, he remembered that Joe had told him that he'd done this before to other boys, but he couldn't remember the names that he was told. He only remembered that the last name of one of the boys started with an S. Thad's dad, Donnie, grabbed a phone book and they started reading out last names that began with the letter S until they came across the last name Steiner. Thad knew right then and there that this was the name that Joe had told him. They told this information to police, who informed them that a year prior, a young boy named Chris Steiner was found floating in the Wisconsin River, and his death was ruled suspicious. So here's a picture of Chris. And he was 14, so he was a year older than Thad, also from the neighborhood.
They're just young kids.
Mm-hmm. I almost find that they kind of look alike, too.
They do sort of look alike.
Like blonde hair, blue eyes.
Yeah.
So July 4th, 1994, almost exactly a year before Thad Phillips was abducted, 14-year-old Chris Steiner went missing. This was the 4th of July weekend, and Chris had been hanging out with his friends all day and went home and passed out early from exhaustion. His parents, George and Kathy Steiner, actually went in to check on him around 10 p.m. and said that he was so tired that he had fallen asleep in the clothes that he was wearing that day. The next morning, Kathy went in to wake Chris up around 7 a.m. because he was due to start a shift at a new job. Chris was gone. Startled and confused, Kathy started searching every room in the house and calling out for Chris, but she couldn't find him. She saw that the window screen in Chris's older brother's bedroom had been slashed and the patio door was left open. There were also muddy footprints in the house, with the footprints being visibly bigger than any shoes that Chris wore. She panicked and immediately called the police. They told her that her son had most likely snuck out and was still out with friends due to it being the 4th of July weekend. Kathy firmly told police that this was very out of character for her son. He was not the type to run away, and he was home and in bed at 10 p.m. last night.
I don't really understand why we need to say, oh, they just have run away. I mean, I know that police have a lot to deal with, and there probably are a lot of missing persons reports, but as a parent, it's so scary to think about knowing that your child would not run away,
mm-hmm.
and you know your kid.
Right.
Knowing that something suspicious is going on and just being gaslit, essentially.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, oh no, it's 4th of July. They just must be partying.
Yeah. Like, you're just supposed to trust a stranger who knows nothing about your family or your child to just chalk it up to a runaway. Like, I can understand if this was like a troubled child who has a history of running away. Like, sure. In a case like that, fine. I can understand why you would immediately come to that assumption.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, just be like, oh, it's probably a runaway, or, you know, it's the 4th of July weekend, so he'll be back soon. Like, at, like you said, as a parent, you would know, like, something is not right here.
Yep.
And having the police not listen to you would be incredibly frustrating.
Extremely. And especially in those crucial first hours of a person going missing. And the more time that passes, you know that statistically, the less chance you have to finding them.
Mm-hmm.
It would be torture
yeah.
to be told by the people that are meant to help you that they just ran away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like I said, I get it. I know they have a lot going on, and there probably is a lot of kids that just run away.
Mm-hmm.
But it still doesn't make it any easier for the parent who knows their kid didn't run away.
Right. Yeah. As his mother had stated, Chris was not the type to run away. And not only that, but there were clear signs of forced entry, with the slashed window screen and the patio door left open. Again, police chalked it up to a typical runaway case and told the worried parents that they'd keep an eye out for Chris. As each day passed without hearing from their son, the Steiners' worry became worse and worse. His father, George, said he would sleep on the couch with the light on and the door unlocked every single night, just hoping that his son would come home. Police had no leads on the case. 6 days later, on July 10th, a body was found in the Wisconsin River by two jet skiers. The body was draped over a partially submerged tree near the Pine Island Wildlife Refuge and was bloated and badly decomposed. The body had to be identified using dental records and was, in fact, Chris Steiner. The autopsy was conducted, and there was no apparent trauma to Chris's body. The pathologist listed the cause of death as drowning and the manner as undetermined. The police came to the conclusion that Chris was out partying with friends that night and accidentally fell into the river, which led to him drowning, and that his friends were just too afraid to come forward with the truth. The parents were left to believe that their son was just left there alone and drowning while nobody helped him. Chris was described as a happy, energetic boy who everybody loved to be around. He loved fishing, spending time outside, and playing baseball. His family would bury him at St. Joseph Cemetery in Baraboo on July 14, 1994, 10 days after he went missing. George and Kathy Steiner came up with their own cash reward for anybody who came forward with information on their son's mysterious death. The local sheriff's department came out and said that there would be no charges of withholding information or for underage drinking if someone came forward with new info. However, during this entire time, Chris's parents were doing their own investigating and were asking friends and members of the community if they had any information, and the same name kept coming up: Joseph Clark, the local teenage bully. So many people thought that Joe had something to do with this that a girl even approached him at school and asked him if he was the one responsible for Chris's death. So like the fact that so many people had a hunch that it was him just speaks volumes as to the type of person that he was.
Oh, an absolute psychopath.
Yeah.
And he clearly didn't have the wool pulled over anyone's eyes, and he just acted like this in public.
Yep, he did. Kathy Steiner had always suspected Joe from the beginning, because apparently Joe was the last person Chris spoke with. Joe was friends with Chris's older brother and had been hanging around the house that day. Apparently, he had actually asked Chris to go somewhere with him, and Chris had refused. Police confronted Joe with this information, and he denied seeing Chris that night. Joe's mother actually had an alibi for him, telling police that he was home that night, and if he tried to sneak out, she would have heard him. Police had no other leads, and the case eventually went cold.
So I suppose we're going to learn that Joe had parents?
Joe did have parents.
Because I was going to say, why was he up in that house by himself, alone?
Right. So he did have parents, but apparently they were gone over in the next town visiting his sister for the weekend or something.
Okay.
So he was alone during this particular period of time when he like abducted Thad, and probably with Chris too. Like his parents weren't home.
And their house looked like that.
Right.
So one might assume that there were some issues.
Right. And I mean, if the mother is actually saying like, oh no, he was home that night and I would have heard him sneak out, I'm assuming that he wouldn't have been bringing Chris back to the house.
Right.
So he must have done something with him like outside somewhere. Mm-hmm. Also, I just feel like that's not like a great alibi. Like, no, my son was home. Like, that's not like a very reliable alibi.
And yeah, I feel like if it's your mother too.
Yeah.
It's like, okay.
Right.
Oh no, he was home.
I would hope that police would look a little further into that. So fast forward to a year later, when Thad Phillips told the police that Joe had confessed that he was the one responsible for murdering Chris Steiner. Chris's case was reopened and his body was exhumed from the ground so that police could further investigate. Upon rereading the original autopsy report, it was discovered that the proper x-rays were never done. So I'm not really sure like the steps that go into an autopsy, but apparently you're supposed to like have all of your bones x-rayed in your body.
That
like
makes
your legs
sense.
And your, you know, apparently that was never done. Not sure why. Again, very, very frustrating aspect to this case, because if that information would have been known, it would have changed the outcome.
Right.
And
it clearly would not have been painted as a drunk night if they realized that he had multiple broken bones.
Yeah.
In different spots that couldn't be explained like that.
Right. And it's like, if you are getting into a career when you're dealing with something as serious as this, can you please do a thorough job? Please.
Right. Yeah, you're dealing with a case that could very well be homicide.
That's crazy, because if he would have been cremated, there would have been no way to figure this out, right? And then on top of that, just the added trauma of the parents having to have their child dug up again. Like, I cannot even imagine what that would feel like. A new pathologist conducted the second autopsy, which included the long bone x-rays. They discovered that the bones in Chris's legs had been broken and the fractures were done in a very similar manner to the fractures Thad had suffered. The prosecutor who worked this case would later go on to say, quote, "When you put these two x-rays on top of each other, the breaks almost perfectly aligned," unquote. So we're going to talk about Joe Clark here for a minute.
I figured it was coming.
Yeah. So Joseph C. Clark was born May 2nd, 1978. He was adopted at a young age by Ron and Bertha Clark. There isn't much information on his biological father, but apparently his biological mother was heavily addicted to intravenous drugs and would use during her pregnancy. So it's unclear at what age he was taken away from his mother and adopted, but I'm assuming during that period of time there would have been, you know, some trauma and neglect going on.
Right.
His adoptive parents, Ron and Bertha Clark, tried their best to give Joe a good life. However, they were both heavy drinkers, and Joe majorly lacked emotional connections with a parental figure for the majority of his life. This led to Joe being an angry child who acted out on a regular basis. Many of his former classmates would recall him being known as the school bully. Joe himself would say that he liked hanging around younger boys in the neighborhood because he could easily bully them. He used to tell off his teachers and be extremely disrespectful and a disruption to the classroom. He would constantly be cornering kids on the playground and finding great pleasure in humiliating and picking on them. When Joe was 14 years old, he looked up one of his teacher's numbers in the phone book and made a death threat to him. So I don't know what this death threat consisted of, but apparently it was pretty serious and the police got involved, so...
He just was evil right from the jump.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. At 15 years old, Joe suffered a traumatic brain injury when he wiped out while riding his dirt bike. Apparently it had been raining that day and the bike slipped in the mud, which led to Joe being thrown 30 to 40 feet in the air and landing on his head. He suffered a subdural hematoma, a broken collarbone, and bad road rash. His father said that after his injury, they noticed a major shift in Joe's personality. He was a hothead who would snap easily. He would often hallucinate and black out and would display psychotic behavior and often have suicidal thoughts. So there have been studies done on the link between head trauma and violence. Aggressive behavior displayed after a brain injury is usually caused by damage to the frontal lobe, which is the area of the brain responsible for emotion and behavior. According to the Journal of Neuropsychiatry, 33% of patients demonstrated, quote, significant aggressive behavior within the first 6 months following their traumatic brain injury. There have been many serial killers reported to have had a significant head injury in their early childhood, such as Richard Ramirez, David Berkowitz, Dennis Rader, John Wayne Gacy, and Jeffrey Dahmer.
I was going to say that I thought I remembered that Dahmer had suffered a brain injury.
Yeah, and it's a very consistent thing with most of, like, the craziest people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it is, but I guess...
it alters your entire brain.
Yeah, and especially if you have that, like, psychotic predisposition, it mm-hmm. just makes you, like, spiral. As for the fetish with bone breaking, it's unclear how or when Joe developed this obsession. So I'm assuming that this would have started with animals, because how would you just know that you like breaking bones, right? Like, it has to start somewhere.
Right.
That, or maybe in his earlier life, he had somehow suffered a bone break and somehow had this, like, sexual thought process connected to that. Like, I don't know. It sounds weird to think about, but, like, this shit happens sometimes.
Something happened for him to make the connection between the bone breaking and it being something that is sexual.
Yeah. So I'm going to explain what sexual sadism is and how it pertains to Joseph Clark. Sexual sadism is a complex psychological disorder wherein the infliction of pain, suffering, terror, or humiliation can greatly arouse someone into an erection and even bring them to orgasm. It's usually acted upon a non-consenting person and causes the victim extreme distress and or impairment. Literally makes me fucking sick to even say those words out loud. Bringing you to orgasm?
To watch somebody in genuine pain.
Suffering. Considering all of this, along with including the sound of breaking bones, suggests that Joe Clark had a very unique aspect to his sadistic fantasies. So there's a few different reasons why Joe might have wanted to incorporate breaking bones into his sexual desires. The first would be power and control. Sexual sadists often derive pleasure from exerting control and dominance over their victims. The sound of bones breaking can symbolize a severe and irreversible act of violence, representing the ultimate display of power and control over another person's physical being. It intensifies the sadist's sense of superiority and reinforces their perception of total dominance. The second reason would be what's called sadistic fantasy reinforcement. For some people, the sound of breaking bones may be associated with traumatic experiences, such as witnessing or inflicting severe physical harm. The sadist's obsession could stem from a desire to relive or reenact these experiences in their fantasies. The sound of bones breaking serves as a trigger that intensifies their arousal and helps them maintain a sense of detachment from the suffering they inflict. The third reason a sexual sadist would take pleasure in bone breaking would be the amplification of the victim's pain. The sound of breaking bones produces a visceral and unmistakable signal of agony and distress. For a sexual sadist, this may enhance their enjoyment by providing explicit confirmation of the suffering that they're causing. The sadist's obsession with the sound of breaking bones might serve as a means to amplify the pain experienced by the victim further satisfying their sadistic desires. And the final possible reason would be the psychological arousal and conditioning. Over time, sexual sadists can develop conditioned responses to specific stimuli associated with their sadistic activities. If an individual with sadistic tendencies has experienced heightened arousal when hearing bones break in the past, they may become psychologically conditioned to associate that sound with sexual gratification. Consequently, this association reinforces their obsession and becomes an important part of their sexual fantasies. Some sexual sadists will keep their victims hostage for extended periods of time, giving them full access and control over them. Some levels of torture can almost bring a victim to death, but to a sadist, there is no fun in a dead victim. So oftentimes they will go to great lengths to avoid death, or even sometimes revive the victim so that the torture can continue. This is very fascinating to me. As horrific as it is, the reasoning and the psychology behind why these people are so fucked up is very, very interesting to me. And I think it's because it's so hard for us to grasp or imagine that these people exist.
Yeah.
But
we'll never be able to wrap our minds around it. But there is, with true crime in general, this intrigue where you don't understand why people do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so scientific, and I know you are too. Mm-hmm. And understanding the physiological and psychological explanations behind these things.
Yeah.
You're right. It is so interesting.
Yeah.
Not in a good way, but it's like, I want to know why.
Right. It's the why for me.
Yeah.
Like the why and the how. Like, yes. How did you become this way? Criminal psychologist John Mayer speaks on sadists and says, quote, "There's no miraculous cure that happens for this. There's no change of life or epiphany that they have. They will go on doing this until they're incarcerated," unquote. So as mentioned before, at the time of Thad's torture, Joe's parents had been away for the weekend visiting his sister in Portage, Wisconsin. He knew his parents would be returning home soon, and his only option would be to kill Thad or let him go before moving on to his next victim. So I think that he genuinely thought that he beat him so much that he would lock him in that closet and that's where he would have died. And then from there, he just would have had to do something with the body, you know, before his parents came home. But he genuinely thought that he had literally beaten him to death.
I had originally thought, I don't know if it was because parents weren't mentioned or it's just how I put it all together, but I had originally thought that he just lived in the house by himself. And that's why he was able to get away with this. But the fact that he did this just while his parents were away for a weekend,
mm-hmm.
that is crazy to me.
Yeah. And
he's like, let me jump on this opportunity and I'm just going to go check a neighbor's house to see if the door is open, to see if there's anybody in there that I can torture.
Right. Yeah. And I don't know how often his parents actually were home. You know, they were big drinkers, and while they were home, it seems like they were always drunk and stuff. So he was, if not physically alone, he was mentally and emotionally alone all of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And as we know with these people, they have nothing better to do than just look for crazy shit to do and inflict pain on other people. So that's what he did. Upon Joe's arrest, a search warrant was conducted for the home. The place was in disarray and there were empty beer bottles strewn everywhere. Police found Joe's journals, which described his parents' extreme alcoholism. One entry read, quote, "Mom and Dad are downstairs getting drunk again. I don't like admitting it, not even in my journal," unquote. Joe would claim his mother would routinely drink to the point of passing out, and his mother denies this. In his journal, police also found multiple sketches of the interiors of nearby homes. Which, like, what? How would you know what an interior of a home looks like unless you had been in the home?
So he was stalking the houses?
Yeah, and like, I think he was breaking into them prior to these abductions and like, or at least, you know, peering in the windows and trying to figure out the layouts of the home. That way he could act out his plan. Like, this was, you know, fully intentional.
And to figure out who lived there and what vulnerable
yeah.
person he could find.
Yeah. Police also found three lists with the names of 29 local boys. One was titled Get To Now, the second was titled Can Wait, and the third list was titled Leg Thing. Police essentially deemed this to be a hit list, and Chris Steiner's name was listed here.
Leg Thing.
Yeah.
A specific list for people who you wanted to do some sort of leg torture to.
Yes. Either that or these specific victims had some sort of characteristic to their legs that he was into. Who knows what that means, right? Like, we don't know because he's never came out and clarified what leg thing means.
Right.
And it's not clear which list Chris's name was on. But yeah, get to now, which basically means, you know, these are at the top of the hit list, can wait, and then leg thing. So very fucked up.
So bizarre.
So Thad's case took over a year to get to trial. During that year, he went through multiple surgeries and physiotherapy to simply be able to walk again. Thad said that entire year he was waiting for the trial to begin, the only thing he could think of was how much he couldn't wait to get up there to testify against Joe Clark. He said he wasn't scared of him at all. The judge ruling over this case was Judge James Everson, the prosecutor was Patricia Barrett, and defense was Mark Frank. During his testimony, Thad described to the jury the torture he endured for those agonizing 43 hours. This included how Joe abducted Thad from his house, broke both of his ankles, then went back to continue twisting his feet after the ankles were already broken, how Joe broke his femur by pushing his leg back as far as he could, and broke his kneecap by jumping up and down on it. He explained how Joe would wrap him up with elastic bandages, put multiple layers of socks on him, and make him walk around in leg braces. He told the jury how Joe would masturbate as he stood over top of him after just breaking his legs, and also explained how Joe confessed that he had done this before to two other victims, one being Chris Steiner. When talking about his broken legs, District Attorney Patricia Barrett asked, quote, "What did your foot look like?" To which Thad responds, quote, "Backwards." She says, quote, "What do you mean backwards?" And Thad responds, quote, "facing up in a direction it shouldn't have been facing." I can't even imagine what that is supposed to look like. The district attorney would also present the evidence of the three lists titled Get To Now, Can Wait, and Leg Thing, and pointing out that this was a list of Joe's intended victims. The defense relied heavily on the fact that Joe had suffered a traumatic brain injury and was trying to plea for the insanity defense. While under oath, Joe told the jury that he had no recollection of any of the events mentioned. He said he, quote, "blacked out," and when he came to, Thad was, quote, "belly aching about his legs." He even had the nerve to suggest that maybe Thad had broken his own bones. The defense brought in psychiatric experts to prove that Joe's memory loss and delusion were signs of insanity. They even had witnesses on the stand who were friends of Joe's to talk about the change that they had seen in Joe after his accident. Joe's parents also came to his defense, saying that they did believe that he had some mental issues and could have possibly been insane at the time of the event, with his mother saying, quote, "there's something terribly wrong. He needs psychiatric treatment," unquote. So forensic psychiatrist Park Dietz was actually brought in for this case, and Park Dietz is very well known for his expert testimony in high-profile criminal cases, some including Jeffrey Dahmer, Betty Broderick, and Ted Kaczynski, and he was the one to perform the psych evaluation on Joe and found that he was completely sane at the time of the event. He claimed Joe was a sociopath and a sexual sadist who had a fetish with men's socks. Dietz addressed the jury by saying, quote, "Joe Clark is a serial sexual sadist who takes pleasure in breaking his victims' legs, but his antisocial personality disorder is not a legal defense to his crimes. Clark is faking his amnesia and then falsely claiming every kind of hallucination known to mankind in order to avoid taking responsibility for his crimes," unquote.
This is so frustrating to me because I feel like this defense is used so often.
Yeah.
And it's like, you're not suffering from delusions, you're not hallucinating, but this is all they can come up with at this point because they're backed into a corner.
Right.
Yes, there is something terribly wrong, but he needs to go to jail.
Yeah.
Because he has something that cannot be fixed.
Yeah.
And he will continue to do what he was doing.
Yeah.
It would be so unsafe for this man who cannot be treated, was not suffering any sort of mental break, to be placed into a mental health facility where he would likely do it to someone else.
Mm-hmm. And they're claiming that this all started from his accident with the traumatic brain injury when he was 15. Like, no, it didn't. There's plenty of evidence beforehand in his early childhood about how he had, you know, these behaviors and characteristics, and he was a bully, and, you know, the death threat to the teacher, all of this stuff. So not really a strong defense, in my opinion. The jury would deliberate for just 1 hour before coming back with a verdict. Joe Clark was found guilty of one count of attempted first-degree intentional homicide, one count of causing great bodily harm to a child, one count of mayhem, one count of causing mental harm to a child, and one count of child enticement. He would be sentenced to 100 years in prison. Along with his charges and sentencing, Joe was ordered to pay a $21 million debt to Thad and his parents to help pay for his costly medical bills. $6 million for compensatory damages, $15 million for punitive damages, and $30,000 in medical damages. Joe, of course, had no money to give at this time, so the judge allowed Joe to make money off the case through media coverage and interviews in order to pay it all to Thad. Which, like, kudos to this judge for doing that, because I feel like that's kind of like a controversial thing. But if all of the money, if you can, you know, prove that all of this money is going right to the victim, then I am all for it.
Oh, absolutely. Because it's not like the perpetrator is
profiting,
making some sort of gain.
Right, exactly. After the verdict came back, Joe's parents came to his defense and claimed that the courts were misrepresenting the facts of the case. They didn't deny his involvement in Thad's case, but denied it being considered torture. His father said, quote, "What we're talking about here is two kids who got into a fight," unquote.
Are we for real?
Right.
Where were the marks on Joe?
Like, if I were Thad's parents, I think I would just want to attack this man. Like, how fucking dare you say that about my child? Oh, it was just two kids who got into a fight? So somehow my child deserved this because Joe was trying to defend himself? Like, absolutely not.
I just don't understand the thought process behind having all of this evidence and being able to see that he's a monster.
Mm-hmm.
And still trying to come up with ways to defend him.
Yeah, I don't get it. I mean, you know, obviously I can't imagine having my child, you know, finding out that they're guilty or, you know, capable of doing something like this. But certainly with this amount of evidence, I would not be sticking my neck out for them like that and blatantly saying, like, hey, he didn't do this, he's innocent. Like, it's just ridiculous. Joe wasn't going to roll over and just accept these charges. He'd go on to file a plea withdrawal motion challenging the, quote, factual basis for his convictions on the mayhem, causing mental harm to a child, and attempted murder charges. So the definition of mayhem is the intent to mutilate, disable, or disfigure another person by cutting or maiming the tongue, to put out or destroy an eye, to cut or tear off an ear, to slit or mutilate the nose or lip, or to cut or disable a limb or other body part. That is so gruesome.
The specifics there?
I know.
Wow.
Yeah.
So he falls under that category. What is he arguing? Were you or were you not trying to disable the limb?
Right. Yeah. So basically it's, you know, disabling someone's ability to fight back and defend themselves by causing great bodily harm to them.
Check.
Yeah. And this definition in some states includes permanent disfigurement. So Joe claimed that causing multiple fractures to another person's leg does not constitute as mayhem unless the victim suffers permanent damage as a result. He argued the word mutilate being part of the definition, saying that mutilate implies permanent injury and that Thad's broken and busted limbs didn't fit the definition of mutilation.
He's all of a sudden some sort of legal expert here and he... He can argue the definitions of things.
Yeah. I always...
And what was his intent? That was his intent.
Yeah, exactly.
Whether or not it happened, does that really matter? That was his intention.
Yeah.
He was torturing him. He was causing irreparable damage to his bones and limbs.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was going to kill him.
Yep. His defense said that due to medical advances, Thad did not suffer any permanent damage. So basically, like, oh, well, he was able to go to the hospital and get it fixed, so I guess it doesn't count. Like, that's not really how it works.
That's not a defense at all.
Yeah. The court fought back by saying that Joe deliberately caused Thad to lose function of his legs by breaking his bones and rendering his legs useless, and that permanency of the injury was not a statutory requirement in that state. And not to mention, if Thad's injuries were left untreated, it would have resulted in permanent damage, if not death, due to internal bleeding. The judge denied this motion.
It just sounds like, obviously, this is an exaggeration, and it sounds like them being like, well, he was able to get down the stairs and he called the police and he went to the hospital and they fixed it. So, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's just stupid.
It doesn't matter. It was the intention and the actions and the reckless behavior done by this person.
Mm-hmm.
Thankful that we have the science that was able to make sure that he's okay.
Right.
Oh, but if that science was missing, okay, well, then we would say
mm-hmm.
that's what he did. That's so backwards.
Yeah. And I always wonder with these types of situations, like, was it Joe just sitting in his jail cell one day trying to, like, think up, oh, well, what's the actual definition of mayhem? Like, maybe I should look further into it. I mean, he doesn't really seem like an intelligent guy. So, but, like, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, was it his idea to try to fight this? Or, like, do these people sit down with their defense attorneys and be like, what can you do for me? Like, we need to find any angle we can to get me out of this situation. And the defense come back and be like, well, like, you could argue, you know, the definition of mayhem and, you know, give it a shot. Like, I'd like to know whose decision this was, because it just seems ridiculous. Joe also argued the charge of causing mental harm to a child, saying that this requires proof that he was somehow legally responsible for the child in question. Basically saying that he wasn't the sole caretaker of Thad, therefore he's not responsible for causing him mental harm. The judge immediately dismissed this because of how ridiculous that statement was.
Like, we're really grasping at straws here.
Literally.
You actually were the sole caretaker because you abducted him.
Yeah.
And he didn't have his parents. And then you tortured him mm-hmm. and put him through mental anguish.
And lastly, he even argued the attempted murder charge. He said that the facts in Thad's testimony were not enough to prove he intended to kill him. Once again, the judge dismissed this, saying that Joe's contention held zero merit. He said the blood that was pooling in Thad's legs was enough to kill him. The pillow that Joe held over Thad's face to suffocate him could have killed him. And the deprivation of food, water, and medical treatment for Thad would have killed him.
I'm glad this judge has a lot of sense.
Right. There would be a second trial for the death of Chris Steiner. Thad was also due to testify in this case as well, but in October of 1996, Thad would be shot in the back shoulder, front shoulder, and cheek by a 15-year-old neighborhood kid named Michael Hibbs.
What?
Just a little plot twist here. Apparently, Michael and Joe were friends, and he must have said or done something to offend Thad, because Thad and one of his friends showed up at Michael's house one day and were going to beat him up, and Michael shot Thad in an act of self-defense. A judge actually granted a restraining order to keep Thad away from Michael. So this kid, Michael Hibbs, would later end up on the sex offenders list at 37 years old for sexually assaulting a 15-year-old girl in Baraboo and would serve 12 years in prison. So, you know, just another stand-up guy.
Well, if he was friends with Joe.
Exactly. But regardless of Thad's new injuries, he pushed through and still attended court to testify against Joe in the Chris Steiner case. He was determined to take down Joe in any way he could. Between the testimony from the kids who had heard rumors of Joe being responsible for Chris's death, Chris's mother's testimony about Joe being the last one to talk to Chris, Chris's name being on Joe's hit list, and the x-rays confirming leg breaks very similar to Thad's, Joe didn't have much hope. Joe's parents, Ron and Bertha Clark, denied Joe's involvement in this case and were absolutely outraged that the case had been reopened and that the police were looking at their son for this. His mother would say, quote, "Joe was genuinely upset about Chris's death when he heard the news. Joey was hurting over the death of his friend and everyone was trying to blame him for it, unquote. Like, give me a fucking break.
I just can't understand how someone can be that oblivious.
I don't get it at all.
You, like, at this point, you are just outright denying facts that are in front of your face.
Yep. Shortly after the discovery of Chris's body, there had been a lot of discussion at school about Joe's involvement. Joe's mother said that the, quote, harassment at school became so bad that they had to withdraw him before he could finish high school.
Oh, booty fucking who?
Yeah. And now that Joe was actually a suspect in the case, they were appalled. The parents would describe it as a, quote, witch hunt towards their son. Ron Clark said that his son was being unfairly accused of murder, and the only reason was because he was seen with Chris the day before. Like, no, that's not the only fucking reason. Like, are you blind?
Apparently.
He said that the courts wanted to charge Joe with first-degree murder this entire time and actually had the audacity to suggest that Thad was being used as a pawn in order to label his son as a murderer. Not only was Joe Clark sentenced to 100 years in prison for the attempted murder of Thad Phillips, but the jury also found him guilty for the murder of Chris Steiner, which he would get life in prison for. When the judge asked Joe if he wanted to say anything, he said, quote, I've done nothing wrong and you're condemning an innocent person, unquote. His parents would echo this by calling the trial bullshit and saying that it was all based on circumstantial evidence and testimonies from kids who like to tell stories. Joe Clark won't be eligible for parole until he turns 112 years old, and today he serves his sentence at Kettle Moraine Correctional Institution in Plymouth, Wisconsin. So in February of 2021, Joe was invited to do an interview with the podcast Criminal Perspective, where the host is asking him questions about the case and he bullshits and rambles for 2 hours about nonsense. So I actually listened to this. I struggled very, very hard to listen to the entire thing, and I don't recommend you listen to it because it's lies, all of it. And I think the host had actually reached out to Thad for an interview at the time too, and Thad was like, pissed that they were even humoring, you know, interviewing Joe.
Of course.
And he didn't want to be involved in this at all. And he actually told them, like, just a heads up, do not believe anything that comes out of his mouth because he's going to lie about everything.
Right.
So Joe would have been 43 years old at the time of the interview. The host asked him what happened with Thad. And again, Joe claims that he blacked out and doesn't know. He really goes on to try to say that it was an argument between him and Thad that turned into a fight.
But I thought you didn't know.
Exactly.
So you can't start spewing out stuff that makes you look less vile and also say you don't know.
Mm-hmm. The host then asks him about the abundance of socks he had in the bedroom. Joe brushes it off as if it was nothing, and then when asked if he masturbated on Thad, he was immediately angry and defensive, saying he didn't do that and that he can prove it. He said the Wisconsin crime lab went through his room and swabbed his entire house and didn't find anything. When the host asked him if maybe he blacked out during this and doesn't remember masturbating, Joe said that that was absolutely not possible and that he knows for sure that he did not masturbate. I don't think you can pick and choose when you black out. Like, if you're capable of blacking out through this entire 43-hour torture ordeal, but you know for sure that during that whole thing you didn't masturbate, like, a little hypocritical.
You are just a compulsive liar.
Yeah. When asked about the second unknown victim that Thad had mentioned, Joe once again rambled on, saying that he never said that to Thad and there wasn't any other victims other than Chris. And for the record, nothing has come out about another victim. People have tried looking into, like, kids that went missing during that period of time and they couldn't really come up with anything. So it's unsure if Joe was lying about, you know, another victim, or maybe he did do this to somebody, but the victim ended up living
right
and just never reported it. You know, it's hard to say. When asked about Chris's body being exhumed and them discovering leg breaks similar to Thad's, Joe says, quote, that's another misconception. They weren't in the same places that Thad's were. A couple of them were in the same area, but not in the same places. Thad had what was called rotational fractures. It's like when you take a piece of plastic and when you twist it, it eventually pops. Chris Steiner had what's called Salter II fractures, which is when you take a stick and break it over your knee and it snaps in two, unquote.
Seem a little well rehearsed on the types of breaks there.
I was going to say, like, it's one thing to hear me read these quotes out loud, and it's another thing to actually hear his voice saying these words. And, like, I remember him saying this and thinking in my head, like, the way that he's describing this, you can tell he's put a lot of thought into this, and he does have some obsession with it.
It's basically, to me, like him saying, well, actually, what I did to Thad's ankles was I twisted them. And what I did to Chris's ankles is that I snapped them. Do you know what I mean? Mm. That's exactly what it sounds like to me.
Yeah.
And the quote, a couple of them were in the same area, but not in the same place.
Yeah, like, what does that mean?
Are place and area synonyms?
Right. The host asked if he was at Chris Steiner's house the day he went missing. And of course, Joe said no and suggested that maybe Chris ran away from home and that someone from a random host party murdered him.
And broke his bones as well.
Yeah, he actually went off on this, like, spiel about, like, oh, you know, there were people who reported seeing Chris get into a car at this party, and then the car drove off, and then there were sightings of this car, you know, crossing this bridge, and there's been reportings of people jumping off this bridge and breaking legs, and maybe that's what happened. You know, these people from this party abducted him and threw him in the car and then threw him off the bridge, and that's how his legs got broken. Like, the elaborate planning of this story and the incredible detail he goes into when he's rambling the fuck on about this was very mind-numbing to listen to.
He's just got way too much time on his hands.
Yeah. Then they asked him about the notebook found in his room that includes the list of boys' names. They asked him what the leg thing meant. Joe said he didn't know, and that even though that notebook was found in his room, it wasn't his, and that investigators tested the handwriting against his, and it wasn't a match.
Is this kid serious?
First of all, I doubt that's even true. Like, I doubt they actually did that. Like, I feel like he's just coming on here and being like, oh yeah, by the way, like, here's my quote-unquote proof that, you know, I didn't own that notebook. Like, that did not happen.
Oh, it was in my room. Yeah. And it had a list of victims.
Chris's name was on there, and it just happened to be in my room.
Oh my gosh.
And finally, the host asked him why he hurt Thad so badly. Joe replies saying that he was defending himself because Thad was trying to attack him. And that because Thad threw himself down the stairs twice in an attempt to escape, it's hard to differentiate what injuries were caused by him and what injuries were caused by the stairs.
If you're defending yourself against someone, they don't have to throw themselves down the stairs multiple times to get away from you.
Right.
It's really, really mind-boggling to me that this guy can't see how contradictory his statements are.
Mm-hmm.
And a literal toddler couldn't be convinced of this.
Mm-hmm.
You were defending yourself against a guy who was completely incapacitated by his injuries, and you left and went somewhere with your girlfriend and they called 911, but you were defending yourself and you don't have a scratch on you?
Mm-hmm. Throughout this entire thing, Joe maintains his innocence and says that some of the things he was charged with are ridiculous. When he can't lie and dance around the questions, all he can do is blame his actions on being a, quote, stupid kid without a grown-up mind. Kevin Heimerl, a detective in charge of Chris Steiner's case, says, quote, Thad was unbelievably strong for that age. And to think of what he lived through over the course of one weekend is something that many people, probably even adults, would have rolled over and given up and allowed themselves to die. And to have to tell that story in front of so many people, not only once, but a second time, is remarkable. He's a true hero, unquote.
It's really, really, really unbelievable to me.
Mm-hmm.
It honestly, in a non-offensive way, sounds made up.
Yeah, no,
I don't actually think it's made up.
Yeah.
But because of everything that he went through and was still able to push through, he's in so much pain, he's passing out.
Mm-hmm.
And he saved his own life.
Yeah.
Yep. And it's so true. So many people would just give up.
Yeah. When I first came across the story, I was like, holy shit. Like, how, first of all, like, there's so many messed up elements here. Like, you're a sexual sadist and you like breaking bones. And then you're going to sit here and abduct and torture this kid who, like, somehow manages to escape and survive. And then, you know, you you're capable or found guilty of murdering somebody else. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Today, Thad is 41 years old and now has children of his own. Sadly, he still walks with a limp, which is a permanent reminder of the torture he lived through. When remembering the events of that weekend, Thad says, quote, "I was thinking about my family constantly through it. I survived because I wanted to be with my family. I didn't want to leave my family, and I knew that they wouldn't want to lose me," unquote. So here's a picture of Thad today, and then here's a picture of Joseph today.
His ugly mugshot.
Oh, he gives me the creeps. Mm-hmm.
When addressing Joe Clark's jail sentence, Thad said, quote, "I hope he gets beat up every day of his life in there. I'd like to get my hands on him. I ain't a little kid anymore," unquote. Thad still to this day has not received 1 cent of the $21 million debt that Joe Clark owes him. I'm not really sure why, because I think Joe has had some interviews.
Right.
So I'm not really sure where that money went. I don't know if it's, you know, the medical bills were so crazy expensive that all of that money went on there and there was nothing left over for Thad, you know, afterwards. I'm not really sure what the situation there was, but Thad basically walked out of there without, you know, any money at all. After it coming out that Thad hadn't received what he was promised, someone in the Baraboo community set up a GoFundMe for Thad, saying that he's a community hero and deserves the proper compensation for his injuries and for giving closure to Chris Steiner's family. If you'd like to support Thad Phillips, please donate to the GoFundMe titled Support Thad Phillips, Real Hero of Baraboo. And that is where we will end episode 23. There are some pretty crazy documentaries and little episodes on shows about this case because it was so sensationalized. So there's the show called Escape, and it's season 1, episode 3, titled Torture in Suburbia. There's the I Survived show, season 5, episode 18, Cold Case Files, season 1, episode 18, and then there's a YouTube documentary titled Teen Killer Kidnaps the Wrong 13-Year-Old Boy. If you guys want to go learn a little bit more and hear Thad explain the story and kind of see the play-by-plays and stuff, it's really, really heartbreaking to think that this poor boy really suffered through that. I can't imagine the fear he was experiencing and just, you know, hoping that somebody was going to come and save him. But to be that resilient that you continue trying to escape knowing what's going to happen if he finds you and you know, deciding like, hey, I'm going to do it anyways, is just incredible.
It's amazing.
And then for him to, you know, have the balls afterwards to be like, I'm not afraid of him. I'm going to testify against him not only once, but twice, and, you know, do every single thing in my power to have my voice be heard and to help, you know, the family of this other victim. It's really incredible.
Survivor stories are just so surreal to me.
I know. It really is.
And the fact that a person is capable of going through something that is so mind-blowingly traumatic and still be able to take it one step at a time,
mm-hmm.
and do the right thing, it's really, really, really amazing.
Yeah. It is. The survivor stories really kind of get me, because it's like, how does this happen? And then you were somehow able to get yourself out of that situation when it's so fucked up. It's really crazy. Anyways, we have a couple like really good survivor stories on our case list that I definitely want to start getting into, because some of the stories are just like next level.
What's that survivor story about the woman who had her arm essentially amputated by a guy, and she was like walking basically in the desert completely naked and ended up getting picked up by...
I have no idea.
I think it was Mary, or...
I don't think I've ever heard of that before.
Maybe I'll have to do it if you've never heard of it.
Mm-hmm. Sounds fucked.
Yeah, it was Mary. Mary Vincent.
Good memory. Which state was this?
It was in California.
Okay.
Yeah. I think I listened to it on My Favorite Murder a long time ago.
Yeah.
but it is a fairly well-known story.
Mm-hmm.
And there would definitely be a lot of information out there about it because she was in the public eye
What's the name again?
Mary Vincent.
Yeah, I don't think it sounds familiar. Definitely and very interested.
She was only 15.
15?
When she was attacked.
Oh, God.
But yeah, we'll start adding some survivor stories into the mix.
Mm-hmm.
Just get a big smorgasbord of
yeah.
true crime.
The options are endless. There are definitely no shortage of psychopaths to choose from.
Unfortunately.
Like,
unfortunately for you.
Yes. Our list is so long, and even every day I come across new cases that aren't even on our list.
Well, we would never, ever, ever get to them all.
No.
So that means that we all just keep doing this forever.
Yeah. Yeah. Endless content.
Yeah.
Fuck.
With that said, it's my turn to do a case next.
Yes.
And I have no idea what I'm doing yet, so stay tuned for that.
Yep. We'll have to wait and see.
Yep. Pull something from the old list.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some really crazy cases on there. I like sometimes I'll go through and just like Google the names and like read the quick little description there. And like the variety and the types of things that go on. Yeah, like it's kidnappings, torture, survivor, missing persons, murders, come back from the dead. Like there was one that I came across on YouTube the other day about how a victim testified from her grave is what it said. I think she was on her deathbed, she had been like burned in a house fire or something by her husband.
Wow.
And right before she died, like they got a written statement from her like minutes before she passed away. And that was used as like a way to get him arrested and charged with first degree murder. So even though she wasn't there to testify, you know, in person, they still use that. But just crazy people out there, man.
I know.
Lock your doors.
Yeah, it's truly terrifying. My brother the other day was calling me paranoid for all the safety measures I have in my house.
Listen, I will happily be paranoid.
And I'm like, listen, you don't know what it's like to be a woman.
No, men definitely don't. Definitely don't.
Or another vulnerable person. My brother's like over 6 feet tall and
yeah. Exactly.
Big and strong. And
I'll try to explain these things to my partner and he'll be like, that's so ridiculous. And I'm like, you would never know because these things don't happen to me when you're around.
Yeah.
It's only ever when I'm alone is when guys will be making their creepy comments or, you know, trying to make passes and just being fucking weirdos.
Mm-hmm.
And when I tell him, like, you know, I don't want to go into the pizza shop to like pay for my order because I don't want to be around the creepy pizza guy. He's like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, I promise this stuff happens. I'm not just making it up. But
right.
he doesn't get it because, I mean, thankfully for him, he's never had to experience it. Like, yeah. I feel like most men have never had to.
It's a male privilege thing for sure.
It totally, totally is.
Not to say that all males have the privilege of not being vulnerable, but
no.
a lot of them tend to be.
Typically, yeah.
Not in a position where someone feels that they're vulnerable and that they're an easy target.
Right. And yeah, I'm definitely paranoid. There's no ifs, ands about it, but I feel like I'm prepared.
Oh,
overly
I am
prepared.
Too.
That's for damn sure. I'm overly prepared and people probably think I'm crazy.
I still have some things that I want to do, so.
Yeah, I feel like I've gotten pretty much everything done that I can possibly think of, but I'm sure there's, you know, there's always new things.
Yeah, I ordered my coyote deterrent.
Okay, yes.
For when I'm walking in the woods in case I come across a coyote.
Right, yep. That stuff sprays quite far,
mm-hmm.
and it's quite powerful.
And it would get a coyote for sure, or something
oh,
larger.
Oh, yeah, totally. I have, like, a big can in my bedside table, and then one in, like, the console of my car
because the coyotes they'll come in sometimes
right. yeah
in
you never know
night.
Right. I've also heard that wasp spray
oh okay
is like a good defense if like a killer is coming at you, just grab the can of wasp spray
right
and just go at it.
Interesting. Good to know.
Oh my
good
god
to know.
All of the things right. Not to like poison your guys' brains any more than I'm sure they already are, but
you don't need to be as paranoid as we are, but
yeah.
put some safety measures in place.
Yeah.
Get yourself a couple security cameras.
Yeah.
Get yourself an alarm system.
Mm-hmm.
Have something to keep next to you while you sleep. That just provides a little bit of a little bit of safety, a little bit of peace of mind.
Right. Yeah.
A dog.
Now that I have my security system, I actually don't know how I survived without it.
I don't either, because it's like, who was creeping around my house?
Yeah. There's so many times when I'll get the notification for like the Ring doorbell come up and it's like somebody's at your door. And it's like, usually it's just like door to door salesmen. But the like how often that happens that I wasn't aware of, it was kind of crazy because it's like there's more people frequenting my home than I actually thought was possible.
I remember one day we saw tracks in the snow that a person had basically walked around to the back of our house.
Oh, God.
And we didn't have it set up at the time. That's and just freaky. Thinking to that and not knowing what it was. Like, it could have just been a neighbor or someone. Like, maybe the dog, their dog ran in the back or whatever.
Yeah.
But just not knowing still now. I'm oh, like, yeah. Wow.
Oh, my mind would just go to the worst imaginable place.
Give me a camera at every angle.
I have pretty much a full 360 degree view of my house now.
I love that. For
which
you.
Is a little much. But like I said, there's no way. Like, if somebody was like, you think that's necessary? Like, you know, could you cut one or two of those out? I'd be like, hell no. Like, I need them all now.
It is a fortress.
Yes, it is definitely a fortress.
Yeah.
Also, like, I just feel like they're good for, you know, if something was happening to your neighbor's house across the street, not even necessarily you, but those cameras can pick up on a lot of stuff.
Oh, yeah. In my neighborhood, sometimes people can make posts on social media and say, you know, a car accident happened at this time. Or this person was driving erratically or this happened and people can pick it up with their cameras and see the accident.
Right.
Which
is like,
huge.
Like cop chases
through
their neighborhoods and stuff. I've seen those before.
I think
too.
I saw one on TikTok where that was through a Ring doorbell camera, like a high speed chase.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy the neighborhood drama that those things can pick up on. Mm-hmm. So not a bad investment.
Okay.
I think that's it.
I think it is it.
Yeah.
That's it for episode 23.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you next time.
See you guys next time.